The Lab takes the ethereal to the practical. Our podcast acts like a business school case study for private equity professionals, CEOs, operating partners, and chief transformational officers. We all know transformation is the key to differentiated alpha. Here's how you actually do it. Our audience tunes in to learn from those in the field, getting their fingernails dirty and driving meaningful growth through better operations, technology, and data. We learn from going to business school, teaching at business schools, and applying these lessons in the real world that case studies actually help the insight stick better. Come join us. Welcome to another episode of the Lab Podcast. My name is Nick Cressy. This time we're releasing a webinar we taped on November 20th. We had the privilege of bringing together some of the brightest minds in private equity, and we gathered the panel to discuss technology value creation within the portfolio. So our goal was to make this a conversation to share strategies and insights and best practices that can help you as C-suite executive or you as a private equity professional thrive in an era where technology is not just a tool, but a catalyst for transformation. Hope you guys enjoy this. We hope it's one of many. It's about a 60-minute recording. Would love to hear your feedback on the other side. Good afternoon. Thank you guys so much for being here. We're hopeful to have a very interactive, thought leadership-led discussion around technology value creation and private equity. My name is Nick Cressy. I'm a managing director at Resourcive. And today we're going to try something a little different. You know, we're going to hopefully open up the lines a little bit and have a good conversation. We've all sat through a lot of webinars over the last couple of years. Goal is to make this one a little bit different, but really my goal is informative and actionable, right? Interactive as well. To achieve that, we brought on some of the best names in private equity, and we'll get into our panelists here in a couple of minutes. Before that, I just want to kind of level set and set some context and lay some ground rules. Sorry. Today actually came about because Scott Estel and I at Landcore do a podcast called The Lab, where we talk about value creation in private equity. We do that with either C-suite executives or operating partners. And the whole idea is to take the ethereal to the practical, right? Get actionable insights. Our audience has been asking for more direct line of contact to our guests. And we said, well, there's no better way to make this an open dialogue conversation than with the three gentlemen we have joining us today. The flow is going to go something like this. I'm going to do this quick outline. We're going to get into the panel, who they are. I'm going to ask some questions, and then I'm really going to be point guarding. I want to distribute the ball and let people come on and ask their own questions. So let's, you know, get in with your question and then hop out. As far as kind of what we're going to talk about, there's three pivotal topics, right? It's best practices of portfolio-wide adoption. So we'll discuss strategies to create a cohesive technology roadmap that aligns with the goals of portfolio companies. We've got change management and support. So we all know at this point, right, implementing new technology is as much about the people as it is about the tech itself. So we'll delve into how to support portfolio companies through effective change management. And then lastly, leveraging third-party vendors. There are so many out there, right, at this point. How do you do it? How do you leverage them to be the best that you can be for your portfolio? So without further ado, let's go in alphabetical order of the firms. And I'll hand it over to Apollo, Steve Foss. Then we'll go Corey at Baypine, then Rob Sears at Carlisle. And then I'll ask you guys a couple of questions and hopefully we start getting some Q&A.
Sounds great. Hi, everyone. This is Steve Foss. I'm the operating partner for technology at Apollo. I've been in Apollo for getting close to 3 years now. Part of that, I was the CIO for several companies, and I worked in Alex Partners for several years in consulting and was in Cerberus for several years in a similar operating role.
Awesome. Thanks, Steve. Corey?
Hi. Hello, everyone. Corey Eves. I'm with Baypine. I've been at Baypine now just over a month. And prior to joining Baypine, I spent 15 years at General Atlantic, where I was the first operating partner at the firm and helped grow and scale the operating team there at GA. And then prior to joining GA, I was a chief product officer and chief technology officer over about 10 years for three of GA's portfolio companies, kind of the greatest hits of GA before I joined GA. So great to see everyone. Looking forward to the discussion. I see a lot of familiar names on the participant or the panelist list. So looking forward to some softball questions from you guys as we get into.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rob Sears from the Carlisle Group. I lead the Office of the CIO at Carlyle. Part of my responsibilities there is managing our strategic technology partnerships for our portfolio of companies. I'm also responsible for driving technology value creation in the portfolio and managing our global network of technology leaders. So I've been with Carlyle for about 5 years now. Prior to coming to Carlyle, I was a management consultant for 11 years, focused on large IT sourcing, outsourcing transactions, and transformation.
Thanks, guys. All right, I'm going to get into a couple questions and then hopefully some Q&A start. I have questions for days. Don't make me ask them all, please, guys. Honestly. Let's start with this one, Corey. I'm going to ask you because you're at Bakewine. You're kind of doing something new, right? This may be a bit of a preface. You know, these may sound a little bit elementary to start, but hopefully they spur some creative thinking. When you're going in to a portfolio company, when you're looking to drive immediate ROI, you're going into a new private equity firm. Are you looking for common themes and wins that you've had historically? Are you looking at particular technologies, line items? Are you looking at leadership and understanding their roadmap? Like, what's the first thing you're doing when you're talking about technology value creation at a brand new firm?
Yeah, great. Well, look, let me give just 30 seconds on Bakewine because I think it'd be relevant. So the new firm that I'm joining, Bakewine, is a firm that was specifically created to do technology transformation. So the whole thesis of our firm is to invest in mid to large size businesses and find those businesses that are in, let's say, more traditional industries, financial services, healthcare, consumer, and those businesses want to then use technology to kind of transform how they do business going forward. So that's the kind of strategy of the firm. It is, I think, a unique strategy. A lot of other private equity firms do this maybe as part of a value creation, or some may shy away from doing this at all. But I think in our case, we're doing just the opposite, which is to actively seek out those firms that, you know, want to do that. Look, I think when I start, you know, my prior experience on this is that I would kind of broadly say a couple of things. One is I spent a lot of time thinking about the leadership team. The technology leadership team, the CEO, the top leadership, you know, the senior executives. And, you know, to start any transformation, it really starts with leadership and management. And if you don't have the right people in those seats, you know, it's really hard to be successful. So when I think about my own time spent as an operating partner and the companies I engage with, that's kind of a starting point. I'd say maybe the second area or phase is thinking about like the roadmap and the strategy of what the firm wants to do. And, you know, I find a lot of companies have, you know, lots of competing priorities, lots of things they're trying to go do. And if they can just be really, really clear about what is the strategy, what are the key objectives they're trying to achieve, and make sure that those objectives are shared, not just across the company, but also between the company and the investors, like that's a really important thing. And, you know, I sort of feel like if I can get those two things right, if I can get the right management team in place and I can get the strategy right for the company, then, you know, everything else becomes sort of tactics and execution about whether it's, you know, offshoring or procurement or implementing, you know, choosing a certain vendor or so on. Those are all problems that we can solve and sort of have playbooks to solve and ways to go do it. But unless you've got those two things, you know, in place, it's a little hard to start to be successful. So that's kind of, those are maybe at a high level, sort of the two places I think about starting.
How about you, Rob?
So kind of building on what Corey said, for us, it all starts with the investment thesis for all of our companies. You need to start there. You need to understand what the objectives of our investors are with that particular company. So it could be a divestiture, a carve out, it could be a platform play. All are going to have their own unique technology needs and objectives. From there, it's really about aligning the technology organization with those business objectives. So often we come into a company or we're working with someone and they talk about themselves as IT and the business. And the message that we really try to drive home is there really should be no difference between IT and the business. There are very few business functions or very few things that happen in a company that are not enabled or driven in some way by technology. So making sure you have that strategy, the technology strategy that aligns with the business, there are going to be short-term ROI opportunities. You can go after things like cloud spend, software asset management. There, you know, there's typically low-hanging fruit that get the momentum and get you started. But really long term, you need to make sure that whatever your technology strategy is and what the tech leadership is focused on is absolutely lockstep with that investment thesis.
Yeah, Rob, I agree with everything you said. We try to start with a holistic value creation plan that includes You know, Corey, to your point, talent includes ESG, it includes procurement and cost out, it includes, you know, technology, and then also focus on risk and how do we minimize the risk in the company. So one of the toughest things, I think, for technology executives is really saying no to the business and being able to step back and say, these are the top priorities and this is the sequence with which we're going to execute them. And having that holistic value creation plan and understanding where technology can impact that value creation plan helps with that prioritization and sequencing. And that's kind of how we try to approach it every time.
Yeah, I mean, I get the pleasure of working with a lot of you guys, but I see a lot of other folks do it a little differently. And the reason we started with you three specifically is you have a very IT focused mindset, right? There are a lot of firms out there that take a procurement first approach, mm-hmm. where it's very much not necessarily considerate of the roadmap. I mean, it's very much go take cost out or whatever that may be. I guess more of a general observation than a real question. It's just, I think the way you guys approach it and getting close to understanding what those executives are looking to do from a roadmap perspective, how do you manage doing that as the portfolios grow? I mean, Rob, Steve, your guys' portfolios are massive, right? Like, how are you that close to understanding what these firms need on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, I absolutely, Steve. And, you know, similar approach at Carlisle, I would say, you know, we work very closely with our deal teams to understand where our priority investments are, where we need to be focused on. Obviously, we'd all love to have probably much larger teams than we do, but it's just a reality that, you know, we can't have unlimited resources. So making sure there's a prioritization and the investments that we're working with and where we think we can drive the most impact is super important. The other thing I would say is that, you know, we spent the last 3 or 4 years really cultivating a strong technology leader community in the portfolio. So starting 3 years ago, we established what we call our engagement model, which is another way of saying we're going to have someone assigned to every portfolio company, working with them to understand the technology strategy needs and also driving the strategy we put in place with them. So it's not saying that we're meeting with these folks every single week, could be a quarter, could be once a year, depending on the maturity of the technology organization and the business. But we do remain close to our portfolio companies, understand where are the opportunities to drive value, where do we need to step in to mitigate risk, and ultimately have the biggest impact on these investments.
You want to add there?
Yeah. I mean, my prior firm, we were closing in on 300 companies in our portfolio. My current firm has 3 companies in our portfolio. So our companies today get all of our love, whether they want it or not. We are going to spend lots of time with those guys going forward. And look, I think for what we're trying to do, you know, to really fundamentally transform these businesses using technology and, you know, digital approaches, I think it does sort of take that, you know, intense focus to go do that. And this is part of the reason we're going to build a portfolio that's relatively concentrated. I think you'll see our firm, you know, take large positions, control positions, and, you know, really try and dedicate a significant amount of resources to our individual companies.
And just one more add-on comment. You know, we try to balance breadth and depth. And so, you know, we try to have, Rob, like you do, that regular touch point with most of the portfolio companies. But where we go deep is where it tends to be the newer assets that we buy.
I think it's important to have almost, you know, a self-service model to the extent you can. So early on, we said we're not going to be able to scale the support we provide our portfolio companies unless, you know, we're putting in resources that can be accessed without having to handhold and, you know, and kind of get in deep. And also working with supplier partners, trusted partners to scale that support. It's really when you start getting into, you know, the 300 plus portfolio companies, you know, that's really the only way you can have kind of the maximum impact across your portfolio.
Yeah, I think that's great. Once you start delivering value to these portfolio companies, how are you measuring it? I mean, do you guys have KPIs? I know each of you, I'm sure you do. I don't know how similar they are. I mean, again, when I'm working with a lot of procurement first firms, it's money. I'm imagining there's a little bit of cost takeout, obviously growth enablement, et cetera. Corey, what are your KPIs?
Yeah, I would say I think about these kind of in 3 buckets. I think some of the activities that we measure, you know, like if we do a specific, you know, piece of pricing work, let's say, or let's say we launch a new product, maybe one of our companies doesn't have a good mobile presence and we help them, you know, launch a mobile presence and so on. I think it's pretty easy in those cases to actually put a dollar ROI against the specific things that you know, we've done. So that, you know, would be sort of one bucket. I'd say a second bucket would be, you know, things that are harder to measure, but, you know, maybe just overall company performance, revenue growth or cost out, EBITDA margin or so on could be a, you know, reasonable, you know, relatively high level, but a good way to kind of look at those things. And then the third bucket for me is, you know, I think there's certain activities that we do, and I'll go back here to, for example, hiring a great CIO. It's pretty much impossible to put a number on, like, hey, we hired the right CIO and he's going to really transform the business. I don't think anyone would dispute that that's an important thing to do, but some of those things are just sort of super tough to measure. So that's a little how I think about, you know, kind of measurement. Maybe just one other quick thought. I'd say there are a lot of cases where there are very specific, you know, kind of operational metrics that we pay attention to as well. So, you know, I'll give you a really good example is, you know, one of the companies I'm working with right now is an online learning business, helps individuals, you know, learn new skills and achieve certain degrees and so on. And the key metric there is just completions, like what percentage of people who enroll actually get a degree at the end. And that's the kind of stuff where most of the businesses have one or two of those key metrics, I think, that are, you know, often maybe another angle of something we look at that's less dollar related.
How about you, Rob?
I agree with everything Corey said. I think, you know, value creation is your ticket to the dance. I think when you're in a role like ours, it's typically going to be one of the first questions you're asked is, you know, what opportunities are there for savings? The only thing I might add is that, you know, we also do a lot of work with our portfolio companies enabling the top line. So with 250 plus portfolio companies around the world, we have a, you know, kind of an ecosystem of our own. So we have a lot of our investments that are interested in working and partnering and selling to our portfolio companies. We also have over 40 technology supplier partners that are also consumers of the products and services of our portfolio companies. So that's another area we focus on. The third area, and I know we could probably spend a lot of time on this, is we have put together our metrics to measure the cybersecurity maturity and, you know, posture of our portfolio companies, which has had a really tremendous effect in working with our investment teams to help understand and make the case for where there needs to be additional investment. So we put together our own proprietary system and assessment that we're working with our portfolio companies that's had a lot of success. There's a lot of different standards out there, but that's one area that's really moved the needle for us in making a difference in investments.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing on cyber with maturity assessment. We're also more and more trying to look at measuring the end of life solutions that our businesses have and how we're reducing that risk. Two other things that we're trying to measure more and more frequently is, you know, failed ERP deployments. Hopefully that number is getting smaller and smaller. And then also we do a lot of carve outs and the execution of the carve out and successfully exiting TSAs on a timely basis is another area that we're getting measured on.
Awesome. Without ERP deployments, that's the bane of everyone's existence. I know that much.
All right. We have our first question. Mark, Josh, you can pass him through. Mark, you can ask your first question. You're on mute. There we go. You're live.
All right. Thank you. Since you have different sizes of portfolio companies, I mean, one of the things in IT, typically for larger companies, is that you do gain economies of scale by having common contracts with major suppliers, be it of software or certain kinds of services. Yet I wonder, when you're dealing with a portfolio and you have different operating companies and maybe they have different timelines for divestiture and such, whether it makes sense to bring them under the umbrella of a broader contract for those kind of services or to keep them somewhat independent and separate to allow more easy detachment when it's time to spin them out.
Yeah, I can take a shot at answering, Mark. So we have several leverage purchase programs that we have for across the portfolio where we can take advantage. But each of the portfolio companies would opt into that. We also have several Apollo framework agreements with some of the bigger companies so that when companies choose to use that technology, they're guaranteed to get certain levels of discount because they're part of the Apollo family. But we do not have any umbrella programs that, you know, all the companies are participating in. That's not how we operate.
Yeah, I would second everything Steve said. You know, it's one of the key tenets that we had, you know, when I started, we started building our technology supplier partnership program is we had to have provisions that would give our portfolio companies enough runway to transition off these agreements because we're not going to hold these companies forever. And that's just the reality of the business that we're in. And so And, you know, we kind of recognized early on that if it was too restrictive or too punitive when it came time to divest that company for them to get off our agreements, there was not going to be a lot of uptake on the front end. So making sure in all of our agreements that we negotiate with our partners that there is the ability to stay on that agreement, even after divesting, if that's a possibility, or transition off in a way that's not going to be detrimental, has really been a kind of a key focus area for us.
Anything to add there, Corey?
No, I think Steve and Rob captured it. The only thing I'd say is maybe just going back a little bit to first principles on that. You know, when you talk about economies of scale, usually you're talking about either things like price or maybe, you know, transferable skills or that sort of thing. And my experience is that it doesn't tend to be the priority. You know, like we don't move people from company to companies for the most part. So, you know, like having people who know one technology stack doesn't necessarily help one company to the other, or, you know, often price is not even the most important thing that we're sort of focused on. So I'd say probably it's a minority of private equity firms that take an approach where they sort of move everyone onto one platform. There are a few out there that I'm aware that do that, but that's just generally, I think, not the approach that the most.
And Corey, I think those ones that do that, they tend to be in one industry, and they don't tend to like, we're all over the place. It'd be impossible to do that.
Yeah. And Steve, you guys have a portfolio that's all around the world and lots of industries and all that sort of stuff. So yeah.
Thanks, Mark. Great question.
Thank you.
Kyle Holt from the Resources team actually has a question. I think it's for you, Corey. Josh, can you queue him up?
Corey, you know, this is a little bit outside of value creation specifically, but you were talking about, and obviously we've talked about it before, around how much of your time you spend finding really great transformative leaders. And I'm just curious, you know, from your guys' perspective, like what character traits are different from those that you see successfully lead transformation and like partner with you really closely versus those who don't?
Okay, character traits. Let's see. Blonde, 6'2". No. It's a good question. Look, I think it maybe a couple of ways to think about it. One is, you know, I think Rob made a really good point on just like alignment to the investment thesis and to the company strategy. You know, I think business, you know, technology, maybe put it this way a little bit. I think a good technology leader, like it's table stakes to be great at technology. Like that's a minimum bar for somebody who can be in the role. To be successful, they've got to be able to build relationships with the business peers, with the CEO. They've got to be able to stand in front of the board and advocate for capital. You know, they've got to have a clear view on where the industry is going and so on. So it's, you know, sort of transcending a little bit, not just being a good technology leader, but being a good business leader as well is maybe one. Maybe the second one I'd throw out, and then I'm sure my colleagues here have some others to add, would just be sort of clarity of strategy, clarity of priorities. You know, like a lot of CIOs I talk to, you know, sort of get crushed by the day to day and they have a little trouble like pulling out of that and just being really clear on like, here are the three or four things I'm going to achieve in the next couple of years. And here's five things I'm not going to do. Like I'm not going to focus on this other stuff. And I think the ones that sometimes struggle are where they bite off too much. They're not clear on what the priorities are. Yeah. So those are maybe two that, you know, pop to mind. Steve or Rob?
Yeah, Corey, I totally agree with everything you said. A couple of add-ons maybe. Executive presence, a business acumen. You touched on that a little bit, but I think that is becoming more and more important in the technology executives. Change management is an area that, because when you're PE owned, you're going to be doing dramatic changes. You've got to embrace that and climb on it. Something that I'm finding more and more is critical with our technology executives is a really good financial discipline, because, you know, we are going to focus on cost. We're going to focus on growth and understanding EBITDA and how that drives MOIC and how important IRR is in our world is critical for any executive in a PE firm and just as important for a technology executive. And then the last one I'd say is around data stewardship. So much of what we're doing more and more is around data and digital. And we need, and a lot of that's driving our growth equation, and having people that are, you know, strong, experienced in that technology set is becoming more and more critical.
Yeah, I think there's a real window of opportunity now with our technology leaders to inspire their organizations, you know, with AI and, you know, kind of the advances in data analytics. there's, you know, our business leaders and people all, you know, from all of our organizations are looking to our technology organizations to drive change, to address problems, to go after opportunities, you know, that they've been probably wanting to for a while. And so having leaders that can really capture that moment and capture the enthusiasm and then the interest in technology that we have right now is super important. And if you can do that while also doing all the other things that Corey and Steve did a great job of laying out, running technology organizations like a business, having a great understanding of the objectives of your business and how it runs in your industry and marketplace, and at the same time, really leverage and lean into a lot of the interest and innovation going on now. I mean, that's the dream package, so to speak.
Yeah. One more add-on to that, and it's de-risking the business because you know, we're playing with somebody else's money here. And we can't afford to have major cyber events, major downtime issues. That's got to be a priority for every tech leader as well.
Yeah. You know, maybe a kind of interesting way. People always like the stories of what didn't work. I mean, I and my colleagues might have a couple of those too. I mean, I just kind of stepped away from a project at my prior firm where, you know, we ultimately had to kind of gently exit the CIO from the business. And why was that? Well, you know, basically the company came to, the company had started a massive transformation program slightly prior to us investing. We stepped in and tried to get the thing back on course a little bit. We couldn't. And ultimately the CIO had bitten off just way more than he could execute on. And he was under a lot of pressure from the CEO. CEO was sort of a big believer in technology and sort of nudged the CIO to sign up for a multi-year kind of big bang, multi-million-dollar, actually a $45 million program of technology renewal. And, you know, 3/4 of the way through the project, they had completed 10% of the work. Like they had spent, you know, $35 million and had almost nothing to show for it at that point. And, you know, so at that point, you know, kind of, for obvious reasons, the CIO, you know, left the business, and frankly, probably others will around that as well. I mean, that's a really good, like, crystal clear, very painful example of, you know, the CIO who tried to do this and was just sort of missing some of the key tenets that they needed to be successful in it.
What role do you guys play in your seats developing those leaders? I mean, obviously, they're in that seat for a reason. Usually, are you helping develop those skills?
I'm mentoring 25, 30 CIOs all the time, at least half of them before they present to the board. They present it to me and get feedback, and I help them to craft their stories. So yeah, we're doing a lot of that.
Yeah, I mentioned the engagement model that we put in place. We have 3 global CIOs that work with our companies in each of our major regions. Myself and then Lucia Suarez, who's our CIO, but also works with a number of our priority companies. And it's a key part of the role. Is a lot of times I think our technology leaders can feel like they're on an island a little bit. And it's, you know, making sure that they have the support and, like Steve said, crafting that narrative. It's super important and helping them do that. A lot of them have kind of the best intentions, but it's just making sure that the story, you know, and the objectives land with the board is, you know, key to success.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Looks like we have another hand raised. We have a lot of questions piling up here, but again, we're going to call on the people that want to speak first. So Joe Vadimo.
Hey, thanks for taking the question. So you mentioned Apollo does a lot of carve-out transactions, and I was curious if you could talk about the balance of optimization of the current tech stack versus balancing massive change that goes along with a carve-out. And how you think about capturing value or the biggest areas of return that go along with that carve-out situation, if that makes sense.
When we have failed carve-outs, when carve-outs take longer, it's delaying the deal thesis of what we set out to do and getting the value capture in non-traditional or the all the other areas. So, you know, there are times where we're doing a carve-out, we are doing some transformation, but I would say we're trying 90% of the time to do like for like.
Same here. I mean, in any carve-out situation, you're going to have to identify who your key suppliers are, your key technology platforms, and it's all hands on deck to get off of that TSA, you know, on time. I think there's a lot of pressure to, you know, to set aggressive TSAs in order to win the deals. And so, you know, that translates to real pressure and, you know, and real need to move quickly. And I think that's also where having partnerships, you know, with, you know, really, you know, capable third parties and being able to bring those into those types of situations really pays dividends. Is being able to go into a TSA or a carve-out situation and know that you have partners that are fully aligned with your objectives, that understand the criticality and are going to be able to deliver on some pretty tight timeframes.
Anything you want to add to that, Corey?
No.
Cool. Thank you, Joe. I have a question here from Matt Podowitz. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm just going to read it off. In your respective roles, do you have the ability to influence or inform the deal team's due diligence approach during the exclusivity period to identify potential value creation opportunities? This is kind of aligned with one of mine. Like, how early are you getting eyes on that value creation and saying, hey, there's a lot to go get here, or it's less about, you know, value creation, more about finding the right leader and, you know, helping this company grow to the next iteration of growth?
Yeah, I'll take this one maybe to start. You know, in our case, myself and the team I lead, we're involved not just in diligence, but even earlier than that during sourcing, which is to say, you know, in our case, we're helping our investment teams think about what industries and what companies could be the right ones to go attempt digital transformation on. So we're involved at that stage. And then as it moves into diligence, we're sort of involved from the very first meeting to meet with the company and help meet management and think about what the value creation plan would be and how technology would translate into that. So I don't know, that might be a little bit unique to our firm, just given, you know, the mandate that we're trying to go achieve. But yeah, we're involved right from the very beginning of the process.
Yeah, we tend to get involved a little bit later in the process than Corey does. I'd say in your question, you mentioned exclusivity, and when we get to exclusivity, we're always involved in due diligence. Sometimes we get dragged in earlier. Sometimes, like today, I got an email about a company we're very, very early looking at, and they're looking at deploying a new ERP. And what do I think about these three pages they talked about? But that was just, you know, very high level stuff. Once we get to exclusivity, we do a formal cyber diligence and a formal IT diligence. And depending on the nature of the company, sometimes product diligence as well. And based on that, you know, we very much influence the value creation plan and what we're going to underwrite associated with that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we're very much in line with, you know, Steve and Apollo's approach in that, you know, and even, you know, in deals where we may not be exclusive, but, you know, kind of depending on the size of the deal, the industry, you know, there's enough smoke there to bring in, you know, kind of our teams. And so, you know, in there, you know, we do conduct, you know, full, as you said, tech and cyber diligence exercises. And coming out of that, a key deliverable, you know, working with our diligence partners is a value creation plan, or at least our own thesis around where we can drive value and growth through technology. And so certainly by the time we get to exclusivity, I would say that we have, I'm not going to say a really good picture, because obviously there's always more data, there's more information and background. You know, you'd love to get in there and talk to more people, but, you know, we have a good idea of, you know, where we can drive value through technology.
And the other thing that we do during that diligence is have a significant impact on the Q of E, because many times they haven't invested in technology and they've got a bunch of end of life solutions that we know we have to. And so we're taking a haircut to our price most times to fund that investment.
The other thing is sometimes technology is the business. So if you're looking at an increasingly, you know, companies that may not be considered, you know, be traditional tech companies are developing digital products. So understanding that and, you know, getting a real clear view into, you know, kind of getting our opinion and our, you know, kind of professional readout on the viability of those products and, you know, where we might need to take those is a key part of the diligence we're doing.
Cool. And then Rob, you mentioned earlier, you have 40 partners, 40, you know, third party folks, firms that you're expecting to deliver value for your portfolio companies. How do you sift through that? I mean, in the last 3 to 4 years, the amount of people that have realized, or firms that have realized, wow, private equity is a really good place to go hunt and align with their value creation. How do you get that down to 40? And then how do you manage them effectively? And also, most importantly, from the portfolio perspective, how do you not inundate these CIOs with too many resources?
Yeah, absolutely. So 2 years ago, we put, because our technology supplier community was growing quite a bit, and all for good reasons, but we put in place our supplier tiering program. So essentially, we have three tiers of suppliers. We group those and we prioritize those based on a couple key factors. One is how much value are they driving for the portfolio? So we measure that on a supplier partner by supplier partner basis. And, you know, in order to be considered a top tier party, you need to meet a certain threshold. We also look and prioritize companies that can do a couple things really well. And one is provide a unified account structure across all of their different geography verticals, industry verticals, because that is not an easy thing to do. So, you know, when we say we have 40 technology partners, how many of those actually, you know, kind of really grasp the way in which private equity works and can support us in the way we need to be supporting our portfolio companies? A much smaller amount. And so, you know, companies that are able to adopt that model, are able to meet those value creation thresholds, you know, we've committed to them a certain level of access and prioritization with our portfolio companies. And that's really kind of the only way to have, you know, all these resources and all these partners, but at the same time, make sure you're getting meaningful interaction, meaningful engagement with them.
But from your seat, Steve, I know you guys have plenty of partners as well. I don't know.
We
40 seats.
I said,
I know you guys have a nice stable of partners as well. I don't know the number, but I know you're always aligning who can create value for your portfolio companies best.
Yeah. And I mean, we have very strong relationships with all the big shops, the Oracles, the SAPs, the Salesforces, the GCPs, the AWS, Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera. And those are where we spend most of our time is cultivating those relationships because they span across so many of our different companies. The more specific vendors, it's more hit and miss and depending on the relationship. But what a lot of times vendors are saying to me, you know, how do I get into Apollo? And my advice to them is always, you know, have a great win with one or two of our portfolio companies and have that CIO come to me with a great story. And then I'll start considering you for other places.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to earn your guys' respect. You can't tell you how good we are.
Especially more than one.
I had no idea this whole time.
The way you get to 40 partners is you have, you know, 30 portfolio companies that have had a really great experience with a particular supplier and can show you, you know, here's how much they saved me. Here's the value they created, you know, and it checks out. And I always tell our partners, there's no better way to generate more wins in the portfolio than to have one of their peer portfolio companies vouch for you and then go to bat for you. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, because we have been successful and growing a really strong tech leader community, they look to each other to understand who's really driving business or value for their business. And those are the ones that they want to work with.
You know, the other thing I'd say is I'm assuming that there are several vendors who are probably in the audience. One of the things I would say, and Nick builds on one of the points you made, is the various firms have gotten much better about covering private equity than they ever used to be. You know, 5 years ago or even more, I think private equity was sort of an afterthought. And there were a couple of companies, an SAP comes to mind, for example, as one who had a really well-organized PE program and it was very successful. And I think what you see now is a lot of other vendors have emulated that sort of approach in terms of how they cover and interact with PE. I see Rob and Steve nodding here a little bit. And for me, what that means is that if you're a vendor, I think there's a pretty high bar to deal with private equity. Like you got to, as Rob said, like have to be able to come in and provide global coverage. You have to understand kind of the nuance of, you know, the private equity firm about how we deal with management, whether we're directive or more consultative. And so on. So I find vendors who come and I get deluged with vendors. My email box is full every day of new vendors. You know, I find the vendors who come in really have to have some of those basic skills in terms of being able to cover private equity or else their ability to sort of break through the noise and get onto even evaluation, never mind a preferred list, is likely not going to happen.
Yeah, Corey, agree with you. And how these firms sell to private equity has to be different than how they sell to a traditional company. Yep. You know, coming in and telling me, you know, this great program that's going to take 4 years to implement and we'll start seeing value after 4 years, they get thrown out the door because, you know, we're not going to own this company in 4 years. And you got to focus on speed and delivering value very early into the investment. And it's a different model than a lot of these guys are used to.
Awesome. Serge Newman has his hand up. Josh, keep pass from throw.
Serge, you're live. Yep, there you go.
Hey, guys, thanks for the discussion. So during the talk, I've heard you guys say a lot about value creation and focus on the higher volume. With that perspective, I'm wondering, to what extent are you guys focused on cost reduction? And I think before I've heard that perhaps that wasn't a big driver, but particularly technology, this is an area that is ripe with cost reduction opportunities. So I'd love to get your perspective on where that sits in terms of priority for you.
Well, that's always part of our value creation plan. It used to be the only thing in our value creation plan, and we've matured to do much more than just cost takeout. But I'd say with almost every company that we buy, one of the initiatives is to drive costs out of technology. And we typically do it through, you know, some of the leverage purchase programs that we talked about before, helping with contract renegotiations, definitely with outsourcing and offshoring, and definitely with cloud migrations. Probably the typical levers we're pulling.
I think this depends a lot on the specific investment approach of the individual firm that you're dealing with. I think some investors, some PE firms are very focused on cost. You know, my prior firm was a growth equity firm. We were really, you know, focused on helping companies grow. And that actually meant that cost was not, it was important, but it wasn't our first priority when we dealt with our companies. And if you go even earlier and smaller, I think you'd find other PE firms are going to, you know, again, they never ignore cost, but if you're a early stage, like late stage venture, early stage private equity firm, you're going to be focused on, you know, winning market share and driving revenue growth and growing your ARR and just a bunch of other factors where cost is, you know, relatively low on the list. So I think this is one of those things that absolutely has a lot to do with what the, you know, individual firm kind of focuses on.
I agree.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add is, you know, it's, we're always focused on cost reduction, but it's not necessarily just cost reduction for cost reduction's sake. You know, it could be part of a larger issue or initiative to shift spend from the back office to the front office, or, you know, enable the technology and the initiatives that you want to be focused on that are going to grow the company, that are going to increase EBITDA at the end of the day. So, you know, the other thing, you know, we look at is technology and the technology departments of our portfolio companies truly serving the needs of the business? Obviously, some of our businesses, you know, are somewhat cyclical, and, you know, you always have to be looking at, you know, is the technology organization that was built, you know, truly, you know, right size for what the business needs today? And that could be because of change in technology, a change in, you know, demand in the business. But, you know, that's something that, you know, it can be a bit painful, but it has to be done from time to time in order to make sure that we're investing in technology wisely in the right areas.
Great. I know we are coming up on time, so I'm going to try to squeeze in a couple more. Virginia Lance asks, our firm focuses on procurement value creation, sometimes finds it challenging to get visibility into the alignment with the technology roadmap. We touched on this a little bit before. What have you seen as best practice to ensure the alignment of the procurement or really any value creation work stream with that roadmap? Again, I think this is going to depend heavily on how involved you guys are in that portfolio creating that roadmap, right?
Yeah. So I actually work closely with Virginia.
Yeah.
And know her quite well. So I'll let you guys answer because she probably knows my answer.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I was going to say, I'm not sure I totally understand the question. You probably understand the question better than I do, Steve. You know, I sometimes, and I'm not sure if this is at all where the question is going, but I sometimes get partners or vendors who come in and they're sort of, you know, like their approach a little bit is like, hey, you know, explain to me everything you're doing and I'll tell you how I can help kind of thing. You know, like, hey, can we come and meet you for the day and, you know, have you take our, you know, through our roadmap and, you know, like talk to me about your strategy and so on and so on. And that's a generous offer. But, you know, if I took, you know, 20 vendors up with that offer, I would never, you know, be able to get anything else sort of done. So I think, you know, where we tend to, you know, work with partners most effectively is if we really understand what the partner's strengths and weaknesses are, and they're honest and open with us about what they can do well and what they can't do well, then we tend to be pretty focused about bringing them in to help solve specific problems or help us with specific initiatives or something like that. So if a little bit of the spirit was the question was like, hey, how do we get visibility into this roadmap so that we can then, you know, sell you stuff that we want you to buy? You know,
that's a little different for Virginia. She,
okay.
she,
She works for ISG, which is a procurement firm that we leverage to manage our spend.
Yeah.
And I think her question is more aligned with, you know, how can they get better visibility? Are there any best practices? How we've gotten partners, I wouldn't say vendor partner, better visibility to the total value creation plan, and even better to be a part of creating that value creation plan? Because, you know, they tend to be brought in after the value creation plan has been created, and they're a sliver of it, as opposed to aligning up front, I think is where Virginia was going.
All right. Okay. So maybe I was taking the wrong side of that question. So Steve, how have you seen that work?
I haven't seen it work well, which is probably why Virginia's asking that question. But I don't know if it's realistic to bringing in a third party and creating that value creation plan. But I guess what maybe we could do a better job of is when we kick off during the sign to close period is typically when we start getting ISG engaged. When we kick off that effort, we probably can do a better job of walking them through the total VCP, not just the sliver that they're going to focus on.
I can tell you how we've at least attempted it at Carlisle. And so we have in the Global Portfolio Solutions team, a gentleman, Adam Cummins, who's dedicated to indirect procurement. Obviously, IT and technology is a part of indirect. So we work very closely together when that VCP is being built. In our European portfolio, we have an even more target approach where we have dedicated, you know, third party team, someone like ISG, Steve, that is looking at value creation plans for every single portfolio company. In both kind of scenarios, they're coming to the technology team to understand what are the resources, what are the partnerships that we have in place so that we're not duplicating effort. They can leverage where we've had success in the past. So, you know, we're kind of learning from our past, you know, successes and mistakes. But really also at the end of the day, making sure that whatever that value creation plan is being put in place, that the procurement team and the folks that are going to have to, you know, go out there and procure the services are fully aligned with whatever the tech strategy is. Too many times, I think we get into a situation where the procurement team has their own kind of goals and objectives. They have a number they have to meet for very good reasons, and that can be at odds with what the technology team is trying to get done. So getting ahead of that process and short-circuiting as much as possible to make sure you're aligned from the beginning is extremely beneficial. And I find myself on a lot of meetings with just tech procurement teams at our larger organizations, just explaining the strategy and walking through how we're going to jointly execute against it.
All right, we got 4 minutes. We have one more hand I want to call on, and then we're going to get you guys out of here because I'm sure you have a four. Ryan Hummel, you can come on and get your question, although I don't think you put it in the comments. We're going rogue here on the last one.
Yeah, can you hear me, guys?
Gotcha.
Yep. Yeah, thanks for the insight, guys. Yeah, my question earlier today, some of you touched on non-technical skills of tech leaders. So board presence, financial acumen. Can you highlight a couple of attributes that when you perceive to be in the court of a highly effective tech leader? And then maybe the second part is, how does human capital and EQ play into value creation?
Ryan, when you say two or three attributes, can you maybe give an example?
What are you looking for when you're doing an interview for a CIO? What are the technical attributes obviously are important. What are the non-technical attributes that you're thinking about when you look for a highly effective, you know, tech leader? And I think the second part of that question is where I'm thinking about emotional intelligence and how does that play back into value creation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Corey, you want me to type in? We've created a scorecard that we use to evaluate all of our CIOs and all of our CIOs that we're interviewing. And it's a pretty balanced scorecard. A lot of it's what we talked about before. You know, we're evaluating their technical acumen. We're evaluating their how strong of an operating technical executive they are. Depending on the type of company it is, product development can be a very critical skill set for them as well. But then it's all those soft things that we were talking about, financial acumen and executive presence and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we got about a dozen items that we use as a regular basis to evaluate them.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. Same. And look, I said this earlier. I'd say it again. You know, I think, you know, building on that scorecard idea, you know, being an excellent technology leader is table stakes. Like you're not going to get to the first interview if you can't, you know, run technology projects, if you're not current technologically, if you're not fluent in some of the latest, you know, technical standards, if you can't demonstrate prior success of various projects and so on, like those are all super important skills that, you know, anyone who would be successful for us would bring to the table. On top of that, they have to have some of these other skills that we're talking about, being able to, you know, lead teams, communicate strategy, deal with the board, you know, inspire followership so that people, you know, track with them from job to job, those sorts of things. And so those are some of the things I find where, you know, not all candidates are equally strong and on those other criteria.
Yeah. And the only thing real quick I'll add on is just their ability to not only tell a story and a narrative and express their vision of where the technology organization is headed, but where the business is going to head. And if you can articulate that to us, articulate that to the board, typically a very strong point.
All right. We are right at time. Thank you guys so much for attending. Thank you to the panelists. Hopefully this was painless enough that, you know, maybe you would do it again down the road.
We'll see, right?
Corey, Rob, Steve, thank you guys so much. And again, have a great Thanksgiving, everyone, and be talking soon.